Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast, where Die's cast to decide the genre in the movie that we're going to discuss. And also, we do interviews of those people involved in making the films. Today's episode is Steel from 1979, and I'm going to be joined with Eric Brooks in a little bit to discuss it. But before we do that, just want to let everybody know that I was a guest host on the Classic Cars Club podcast with Jeff Owens and Richard Chamberlain on episode 83, Fingorama, where we discussed Mothra versus Godzilla or Godzilla versus the Thing. So I hope you guys give that a listen too. I enjoy going on their podcast, and those guys have been on ours. And just to give everybody an idea what the Classic Cars Club podcast is, we're going to listen to a little promo of it. And then right after that, Eric's going to be joining me for our discussion about Steel. Hope everybody enjoys it. Bye.
Hi, I'm Jeff Owens.
And I'm Richard Chamberlain. And we want you to join our club, the Classic Horrors Club.
Every month, Richard and I host the Classic Horrors Club podcast, where we talk about our favorite subject, horror movies.
Some of them are classics.
We all go a little mad sometimes.
And some definitely aren't.
What you see is real. What's done is done, and what I've done is right. It's the work of science.
But we love them all the same. We also have special theme months where we highlight the legendary stars.
And we head to the drive-ins of the past every summer for exciting double and triple features.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle.
And we even have occasional guests.
My obsession, and it is truly an obsession, I suppose, of Frankenstein, the true story, dates back to when it first aired in two parts on NBC in 1973.
So join the fun and listen to the Classic Horrors Club podcast today. Hosted by SoundCloud, we're available wherever fine podcasts are found. And for even more fun, check out the video companion on our YouTube channel.
And remember,
we sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the newest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast, where normally the genre of the movie we discuss is decided by the roll of a die, but this episode, we want a little different. I was listening to the B-Movie Cast, episode 515, when they were talking about one of my favorite movies growing up, The Norseman, and they were not treating it well. But during that episode, Eric Brooks brought up a Lee Majors movie that I never saw nor even knew about called Steel from 1979, and I thought, I'm not going to wait for the dice to decide this one. I saw it was available on YouTube. I reached out to Eric Brooks and said, Eric, do you want to come on the show to talk about Steel? And he said, yes. And how you doing today, Eric?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Stephen. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. This is a neat film. And for me, a native Lexingtonian, well, near native Lexingtonian, live here most of my life. It has a special place because we don't get to see ourselves in big films like this very often. So I'm glad I brought it up, and I'm glad we have the opportunity to do the podcast. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. And if you enjoy it in the future, we'll do our normal way where we'll roll the genre dice and you'll get to decide.
Cool.
You'll find out the genre and you get to pick the movie yourself.
That's neat to know. All this time, when I saw Diecast Movie Cast, what formed in my mind was Diecast like as in Hot Wheels. I thought you like diecast metal or something. It never occurred to me. And I guess I've listened to it some, but I didn't really know you all did it by die. That's pretty cool. I like that.
Oh, you're welcome. My children named it. So
great.
You know, it is what it is. I mean, half our episodes are interviews, which has nothing to do with a diecasting at all, but
right.
You know, it's the title.
Great. Yeah.
But just so listeners know, if that are not familiar with you from the B-Movie Cast, what do? That you want to tell people for a living?
So, my name is Eric Brooks. I live in Lexington, Kentucky. I am a museum curator by profession and have been now for nigh on 30 years. Most of that time at Ashland, the Henry Clay Estate, the home of Henry Clay, which is why I have the background I do. I think I developed this during the pandemic. We were doing a lot of this kind of thing during the pandemic, and so I picked a room that I liked in the house and made my background out of it. And I guess I've just never bothered to change it. So there it is. Anyway, that's what I do for a living. I am a B-movie geek, I guess you would say. Go to a lot of cons, watch a lot of films. I got into the B-movie cast, for those of your listeners who have heard Nick Brown, and he's, I think, been on your cast a couple of times.
Yes, he has.
Nick and I have known each other since we were sophomores in high school, so we're at 38 years now, hanging out, watching movies, etc. And I knew he did the B-movie cast. And more than once I was present when he was recording live, or he used to in the past when he was traveling or other things. If he wasn't going to be available to do it live, he would do what he called a Nick bot, which meant he recorded it and then they just played it into the cast. So I was around for several of those. So I got familiar with the cast, and then eventually Nick invited me on, and I primarily do films with them that either are historical, anthropological, archaeological, that sort of thing. My main things are mummy films. I've done several mummy films with them, and Indiana Jones. We did Raiders of the Lost Ark a little while back for its 40th anniversary. So those are the kinds of things that fall in my wheelhouse that I normally do. So today's film isn't really that, but it falls into a different area of expertise, which is that it is a local film for me.
Oh, exactly. And I want to say for listeners, Eric and I are Facebook friends. He does a great Indiana Jones cosplay.
Thank you. It's something I've gotten into and I enjoy doing it. I didn't know when I started doing it, the depth to which many people who do it go. I'm on all sorts of Facebook groups and things, and the conversations that come up sometimes just boggle the mind. You know, like, I'm trying to make my hat look like it did in the tank scene in Last Crusade, and do I have the crown right, or do I have the dust right? Wow, somebody got some time on their hands. I mean, it's amazing the detail to which people will go, and I haven't gone anywhere near that far yet. Mine's not bad. In fact, mine's pretty good, but it is not quite that level. I mean, I haven't. You can spend a lot of money doing it. It you know, if you wanted to, you could easily spend probably $2,000 to $3,000 on a full screen accurate, high quality cosplay. I mean, if you wanted to buy the screen accurate whip, the jacket made by the people who made the ones for the movies, etc., it adds up. It's kind of amazing, really, but I enjoy doing it. And in this lately, it's been a great time to be indie, I guess you would say, although I am afraid that indie has taken a backseat to Barbie and to J. Robert Oppenheimer, which is a little weird, but anyway, that's what happens. And then for me, the downside to that, or the challenge to that, is that my wife is a major Barbie collector. She has about 1,000 in the box. And so now I find that my cosplay and my hobby is taking a backseat to hers. So I don't know. I may end up getting forced into cosplaying Ken here sometime in the near future, which will be potentially unpleasant for viewers. I don't know. Not sure I'm really cut out for that, but we'll see.
Well, for a deep cut, because I've seen the movie with my daughter and wife, Barbie, they also could have you cosplay Andy, the friend of Ken.
Okay,
the friend
I haven't seen
Ken.
It yet. I will say I have every intention of doing so. Everything I've heard about the movie is spectacular, and I want to see it now. So I will. And perhaps that might work. I mean, I'm sure we could find something in there. Anyway, we'll see where that goes.
And for listeners wondering, my wife and daughter and I saw a double feature. We didn't do the Barbieheimer because when they were on vacation, they did a girls' trip, came back, and then we went out the next day. So the two movies my daughter wanted to see, and my wife came with us, was Barbie and The Haunted Mansion. And we did them in that order. And both of them enjoyed The Haunted Mansion more than Barbie.
Huh. Wow.
So it's they're not saying Barbie is bad. They enjoyed Barbie, but they enjoyed The Haunted Mansion more. So I mean, they enjoyed both movies overall, and so did I. But I look at it. I'm not the target audience for Barbie, but I figured those two were. So that's why I gave, you know, figured you and I could talk about Barbie for about 5 seconds and pretty much exhaust our knowledge. Yep.
Well, sadly, I probably have more knowledge than that because, like I say, my wife has this huge collection and we go places like flea markets or Peddler's Mall or whatever. And invariably, if Barbies appear, we have to stop and try to figure out if she has them and that. So I've learned more about Barbie than I really ever wanted to know. But yeah, that's close to right. I mean, certainly not an area I have intentionally explored. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. But one area that you and I intentionally explore, I believe I can safely say, is Lee Major movies.
There you go. And TV shows. Yes, indeedy.
And when you again, set on the B-movie cast, Steel, 1979, and then you were saying how it's hard to find. You can't find it. I hate to break this to you, Eric. I popped it in on a web search, and within 10 seconds, I found it on YouTube, a couple different versions of it. And then I found out when I did the shopping that, listeners, if you want to get it, it's a gray market purchase, if you know what I mean, but you can get it from 10 to 20 bucks, you know, if you want to get the DVD from just a quick search on the internet.
It seems like it's recently become more available. For a long time, it was next to impossible to find. Having grown up in Lexington, it's one of those things that's talked about around here. And I had never seen it until 4 or 5 years ago. Lee Majors actually came to the Lexington Toy and Comic Con, and almost immediately after, the library showed Steel downtown at the downtown branch in their theater room. So I saw it there finally. And I don't know when it went on YouTube, because I've looked for it before, but it is there now, and there's a very, very nice print. The one I watched, man, it looks great. I don't know if it's been restored, but it looks really, really good. I mean, compared to what some of them look like, it was better on YouTube than it was when I saw it at the library. So I don't know what the library was projecting. Could have been an old VCR tape for all I know. But yes, it is available. Yeah, I know beyond question that Juan at Fifth Dimension Films, and Fifth Dimension Films on the internet, you can search that. Juan is another member of the B-Movie cast. He has it. It's a little more expensive. I don't know what exactly he has, a DVD or a Blu-ray, but he has it, so you can get it from Juan if you can't find it elsewhere. But it is on YouTube. Just search Steel Movie, Full Movie, or whatever. It comes right up. So, yeah, it's right there. And well worth a watch. I think this is a film that has gone unnoticed for a long time, and I don't really know why, because I think it's a kind of neat film, and it's got some really important actors in it.
Oh, I agree. And one thing to add to your search, add 1979 with Steel. So that way you don't get, that way it totally takes out the Shaquille O'Neal Steel.
Yeah, I'm into that.
that's a movie of a different sort. That one.
Yeah.
Quality varies.
Right. There you go.
But yeah, this movie, to me, it's a forgotten gem of a movie. And if you wouldn't have brought it up as an aside, I still wouldn't have known about the movie. And that's where it's nice about, I know sometimes everybody gets upset when two movie enthusiasts are talking about movies, and sometimes they bring up another movie or two. Again, you don't want to go crazy down too many rabbit holes. But when you can bring up a movie or two that, especially you had seen and had some knowledge of from your area, your location, it added something to me, because I was just like, wait a minute. And as soon as you guys got done saying that, I was driving in the car. As soon as I got to a stop, that's when I was doing all my stuff. So I was like midway through the episode. I'm like, write this down. Don't want to forget it. And then I did all my little searches and notified you. And did you watch the YouTube link that I sent you? Was that the one you watched?
I think so, yes. I didn't click the link directly. I just searched it up. But I think it's the one you watched. I mean, it was, like I say, a really good print. It was very clear, clean. Color was really good. Audio was really good. All the way around, it was a really, really nice print. So whoever's it was, I didn't look. It's the first one that comes up when you search for it. So I didn't look, you know, to see how many different versions there were. But, yeah, I think it's the one that you sent the link for.
And before we get into the cast and talk about scenes that we really enjoyed or things we enjoyed about the movie, I'm going to give you a brief synopsis of the movie. To me, this is like an action movie done on a construction site about construction. So it's kind of an interesting thing with an action movie that's different than your normal action movies. So it's like an action drama or an adventure movie. It depends how if you're trying to classify it. But Big Lou, who's played by George Kennedy, has a building he's trying to construct. And he's having to fight off financing or get financing. He has certain deadlines he has to meet and so on. And he's going up the building and he dismisses an employee, takes that guy's place, and him and this new guy are going to put the beam in. And the guy freezes because there's an explosion below them. And even though they're safe, the guy freezes and holds on to the beam. So Big Lou goes across the beam to help him out, gets that guy free. But as he's getting freed, he falls from the top of the building down and perishes. And then basically his daughter, Cass Cassidy, played by Jennifer O'Neill, wants to take up and get the building finished. And she has a few weeks to get 9 more floors done before she loses it to her uncle, which is the younger brother of Big Lou, Eddie, played by Harris Yulin. And pretty much that's the plot of the movie, Tim trying to save the building. So she talks to Art Carney's character, who's Pig Nose, and he says there's only a couple people that can do this ramrod of a job to get it done. And pretty much he said to go to Lee Majors or Mike Cotton. And she finds him, gets him. He picks his crew. And it's a crew, for when we talk about these actors later, it's a crew of people you've seen in so many movies. And a lot of these guys usually play the villains. But here they're on the heroic team, so to speak. And they try to finish the building. Are they going to get it done by the deadline? Is Eddie going to be able to stop them? Will it be finished? I won't tell you now, but I will tell you when we get to the spot when we're going to spoil the ending. So this, that way listeners will know. So at this point, it's not spoiled. And if you want to watch it, it's right there on YouTube. You can watch it and pick right back up where you left off, or you can just live dangerously that spoilers might happen. Is there, did I leave anything out that you would add?
That's pretty much it. I mean, that's pretty much the story. It could be, it's a very suspenseful, tense film. If you have any vertigo or fear of heights, it is surprisingly effective at communicating height and being on a narrow beam and all of that. I guess I have developed more of a fear of heights than I probably had at one time in life. And I felt a little afraid at times when they shot down, you know, looking over and whatnot. So, you know, it is an action film. You wouldn't think necessarily the construction would be something that action filled, but they make it so in the way that they shoot the film, which is really interesting.
I definitely agree with you about the height thing. When they're walking around those beams and they're shooting the camera down and you can see, can you imagine that this film was done in 3D, the depth, how you would see all that still? I was like, oh, am I going to ever do that job? Hell no. I would not be walking that beam.
No. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine the people that actually do that job. You know, being able to do what they're doing, and I couldn't do it. No way. I would not last 5 minutes.
And I want to give credit to the director, Steve Carver, you know, who some listeners will know from Big Bad Mama. I remember him from 2 of the Chuck Norris movies that he did, Lone Wolf McQuade and An Eye for an Eye. I mean, this is a guy who's used to doing some action films, used to working in the lower budget area. And he does a very effective job of getting this movie across and doing it. I mean, it's just, I was pretty impressed with it.
Yes, I agree. He really chose his shots well. It looks really nice. It's, you know, interesting visuals. He maintains the tension and keeps you on the edge of your seat the whole time, the way he chooses to do it. So, yeah, I thought he did an excellent job of putting it together.
And the music, I was surprised how good the music was of drawing you in by Michael Columbier. If I'm saying his name wrong, listeners, I'm sorry. But, you know, but he did it. The music was really, really nice and enjoyable to draw you in and to get that tension at certain spots built up. And it starts off really well with the music. I mean, it gets you really into the movie. It's especially for a movie called Steel. And originally, it was, when it was being filmed, it was going to be called Look Down and Die. But sadly, I'll let you tell the story in more detail. Sadly, a stuntman died after the film was done. He died because he wanted to break the world record that another stuntman broke. So they just filmed that scene after it was all in the can. So basically, he didn't need to do it. The stunt was already done prior by him, but he wanted to do it at a higher height and chose to do it. And I'll let you talk about his name and things like that, because that was a big thing in your community.
It was. This film was a big thing in our community. Lexington is not a place where lots of big films get made. I mean, there have been some, especially since then. I think at the time this was made, it was probably the first film of this sort ever shot in Lexington. There were a few shot in the area. There was a film called Rain Tree County shot elsewhere in the bluegrass. The sets for it are still in existence at a place called the Pioneer Playhouse Theater, which is in Danville, which is about 35 miles south of Lexington. So you can go there, and if you go to see a play, the sets are at the front. You can see them around on the property. But there hadn't been very many. And so for Lexingtonians, there hadn't been very many films shot around here. And that was a big deal. I mean, the local people being in it. It also was shot at a time when Lexington was moving from somewhat sleepy, sort of small country town to real city. So when this was shot, the building that they shot on, which is why they came here, they wasn't that they wanted to shoot in Lexington particularly. It was that they needed a building under construction to shoot the film. And it happened that the building that you see in the film was, it's a building called the Kincaid Tower, named for a man named Garvis Kincaid, who was the CEO of a bank. I think he was involved in the financing of the project. But it was being constructed, and it was far enough along that they could shoot on it and get what they needed, but not so far along as to be past where they wanted it to be in terms of the plot of the film. So it worked out really well. But that was the first real modern skyscraper in Lexington. And there are a lot now, but it changed Lexington. And there are other buildings right next to it. Periodically, they pan back, and there's a large, almost white-looking rectangular building. That's the Hyatt Hotel, and next to that is Rupp Arena, where the Wildcats play. And there's a scene in the film shot in Rupp Arena, and they did that to some extent because the people here in Lexington wanted to show off their new state-of-the-art, best-in-the-country arena. I mean, when it was built, it was as good as any arena used by the pros. It was top flight, and it's still very nice. It's not quite so much now. It's been bypassed, and I mean, it's 50 years old almost, so that's to be expected, but I mean, they're showing that stuff off. So that's right there beside Kincaid Tower. So it was a chance to show that off. And watching it now, it's weird to see the city as it was then and how much more it's grown even since then. There's an area that's sort of triangular where a bunch of cars are parked. I think it's where all the construction guys parked. That's called Triangle Park now. And there's a big fountain along the edge adjacent to the Hyatt. And then the rest is a big grassy park. They have a little cafe there. In the wintertime, they put out an ice rink. So it's a important kind of center of town, if you will. But a lot more has been built since that time. There's a lot of stuff in this film that simply isn't there anymore because it's been torn down and rebuilt, which is both good and bad. But it's a neat artifact in that way, but it was a big deal at the time. And to have Lee Majors shooting it was a big deal because Lee Majors, although born in Virginia, grew up in Middletown, Kentucky, which Middletown is in the southeastern corner of the state, all the way on the Virginia and Tennessee state lines. It's a little small coal town that's claim to fame is being the only town in the world built in the middle of a meteor crater. So anyway, it's way out there, but that's where he grew up. He played high school football, went to the University of Indiana, got into some trouble there, I think, with a frat or something, ended up transferring to EKU and played football at Eastern Kentucky, which is only 20 miles down the road from Lexington. So he was kind of local in that sense. And then got injured playing football and discovered he had a congenital spinal problem that prevented him from continuing. So he decided to try acting. He actually went to the Pioneer Playhouse, which is a summer stock theater, and a number of actors have gone there to develop their craft. Another big one is John Travolta. But he goes there, works there, then goes on to a career in Hollywood. So to come back, he's shooting Lexington. Well, that was kind of a crown jewel. I mean, that was awesome to have a person with that kind of Kentucky connection shooting here. So they shoot the film, and it was a big deal. I mean, I'm sure streets were closed and, you know, people were watching the filming and trying to meet stars, and they were probably going to local restaurants and that sort of thing. They get it done. It is in the can. And after it is finished, A.J. Bakunas, who is one of the stunt people in the film, he's also in the film. He plays a goon, and I think he's one of Eddie's guys who either beats up Pig Nose or whatever. He's one of those goons. A.J. Bakunas had done the jump, and he had done it about halfway up the building, the fall, Big Lou's fall, and everything was fine. It's all in the can. Well, A.J. Bakunas had a good friend, Star Robinson. Star Robinson and A.J. Bakunas were probably the top stunt people in Hollywood at the time, or two of them. Both guys who did a lot of high fall work. In fact, A.J. Bakunas set a record doubling Burt Reynolds in the film Hooper by dropping, I think it was 232 feet onto an airbag for the all-time freefall record. Well, after the film Steel was completed, he finds out that Dar Robinson has since exceeded that record. And he can't have that. He's not going to let that slide. So he calls up the production company and says, look, I want to redo the jump. I want to go from the top of the building. And they say, look, we appreciate all that. That's great, but we're done. Everybody's gone home. There's no one there. We can't bring a whole production back to shoot one jump for no more reason than you want to shoot at the top of the building. And he says, look, I want to do this. It will be great. It'll make the film. Come back. I'll pay the cost of bringing the people that are necessary. So they bring back Lee Majors and a few of the other folks who are supposed to be there for the jump and that sort of thing. They don't need the whole cast, but they need the ones that are there for that scene. So they bring them back, set up the airbag, and he does the fall from the top of the building, as high up as, and that's like 300 and some feet. He also has his father in attendance. His parents had never seen him do a fall. His mother was so petrified by what he did, she did never come. She would never show up for his films because she didn't want to see what he was doing. It was so scary to her. But his father finally did. He said, I'm going to come see you set this record. So he's there. This was announced, I'm sure, in advance. Whole city of Lexington shows up, people all around everywhere, you know, watching what happened. So he does the fall, he hits the airbag, and it splits, which means instead of landing on a mat full of air, the air comes shooting out, and he goes straight through to the pavement below. It is immediately obvious that this has gone wrong. And so he's in the middle of this collapsed airbag, so no one can really see him at the moment, but EMTs and others rush in. Lee Majors went to his side. I actually talked to Lee Majors about this when he came to Lexington Comic Con. He did a Q&A, and I asked him about it. And I think I was about one of the few people in that room who knew about Steel and could ask. And so he talked about Bakunas and being there and going to Bakunas' aid. He was critically injured, suffered massive trauma to the chest and head. They were able to load him into an ambulance. They took him over to University of Kentucky Hospital, which even today is our major trauma center. He was admitted to the hospital. They treated him for about 24 hours. And after 24 hours, his injuries were simply too great, and he expired. He was just shy of his 28th birthday when he died. So a horrific tragedy that clouded this film. And it may be one of the reasons that it does not get more play. People may have been so horrified by it, they just felt, we don't want to put too much attention on it. Although it aired on TV, it was the only versions available for a long time were pan and scan versions that had aired on broadcast television. So it did air. And the film was dedicated to him. It ends with a dedication to AJ. And the fall that they used in the film is the one in which he was killed. So, unfortunately, what you're seeing is him plummeting to the ground in that shot. That's, they wanted to keep his attempt at that high fall in the film in honor of him, so they did. Dar Robinson, the other guy, continued on, did a number of big action films in the 80s, and was shooting a film in about 1987 doing a motorcycle stunt. And he went careening down the road on his bike, hit a rock or something, went off the road, and ended up flying off the bike and impaled himself on a tree and died at about 35 years of age. So these two men are inextricably linked. They were in several films together. There was a film called Stunts, I believe, which is about stunt people.
Oh, you mean the
that
stunt?
They were both in.
You mean the stuntmen?
No, I think it's called Stunts. It may be that. There were several films done in the late 80s, or late 70s, rather, that sort of were homage to stuntmen. I mean, this is the era before CGI and all that. So when you wanted to do a fall, you had to do a fall. I mean, you couldn't do it otherwise, generally. So, you know, that was a different time. And these stuntmen did this stuff. And so there were people who made films in tribute to what they were doing. So they were in at least one film together. They were both in films with Burt Reynolds. In fact, Dar Robinson did a film with Burt Reynolds, and I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but Burt Reynolds shoots the guy, and he goes flying out the window of the Peachtree Tower in Atlanta. That's Dar Robinson doing that fall. So, I mean, they had very similar careers, were very close friends, obviously had a sort of competitive relationship, and they both ended up dying very young doing stunts on films on which they were working. So, I mean, it's a real sad tragedy. I mean, it's horrible to think these two guys lost their lives at such a young age. And so I think that cloud has always hung over this film and always kept it from being more than it otherwise might have been.
There was a thing I saw on YouTube. It's about 5 minutes long. I don't know if you had seen it yourself. And it's basically showing archive footage where Lee Majors and AJ are talking before he does his jump, interspaced with current, or at the time that 5 minute thing was made, with people reacting to it then, including the doctor that worked on AJ. He was also, the doctor for the film. And he was adamant that it shouldn't be done. He's like, the film's in the can. There's no reason to do it. It's too risky. And AJ fell and ended up going, he was at the emergency room at that time, and he was being relayed information by the paramedics as it was going, as the fall was happening. So he knew what was going down, and he ended up being the one to work on him. And he said, if I remember correctly, that his brain and other stuff was fine. It was the lungs that were critically damaged, and that's why he passed away within 24 hours. And he was just, he said, I should have pushed harder to keep it from happening, but that's always one of those things, anytime a doctor does it. The interesting thing about that, and this is brought up by the person who was doing the narration, and they saved it for last, Lee Majors' last line, after AJ walks away from him to go do the stunt, and Lee Majors comes down, I guess, to the ground level to see it happen. Before he does that, he goes, he's doing this to break a world record, and something that goes along the lines of, is it really worth your life to break a world record? And that was recorded. And of course, you know, and people do that. They push the boundaries of doing things all the time. And sadly, there are a lot of tragedies like this for people that tried to push that boundary and were not successful and things like that. But it just, you talk about a line that's so chilling that he said, not knowing just minutes later how that was going to play out. You know, that's, and you right. said talking to Lee Majors, like you said, at that one thing, that had to be, you know, something that stayed with him all that time.
It did. Absolutely. I think there was no question that he was devastated by it. I think he'd become friends with Bakunas during the filming. And I mean, anybody would be devastated to see something like that happen. See someone you worked with doing something like this, and, you know, a freak failure I don't know why the airbag failed the way it did. I don't know if somebody failed to do something in preparation. I don't know if it was just one of those things that, you know, maybe it was old. I don't know. But to have that kind of freak failure, wasn't that he missed the mark. It wasn't, you know, some other thing. It was that the piece of equipment failed and failed him. That's got to be devastating, and it does have to stay with you. And it would have, I think, made it very difficult going forward. You know, normally when you do a film, there comes a point where it's all in the can, it's all made, and you're getting ready to release it. You do publicity and that. That would have been hard to do on a film where you knew somebody died like that, you know, making the movie. I mean, there are plenty of other examples of somewhat similar circumstances. Twilight Zone comes to mind, The Crow. There are other films where people have been killed making the film. And I think those films always have that shadow hanging above them that separates them from maybe being totally successful. So it's a very, very unfortunate thing.
And I'm just going to tag on with what you said is the film was done, like we said earlier, and really there was just no reason for him to do it except he wanted to break the record. And so it's not like he did the stunt to get the film done. It was done. He did it because he wanted to do it. And that is, to me, it's the sadness, because there would have been films down the road. He could have had, and I'm sure there would have been another film with the fall that's going to be in it that he could have made his attempt to break the record. Who's to say? But that was one of the main reasons the film name was changed from Look Down and Die to Steal. You know, because obviously it didn't sit well to have a film called Look Down and Die when somebody actually fell to their death and died.
Right. Yeah, you couldn't do that. There's no question. Quite honestly, the title Look Down and Die does make some sense once you see the film. But they couldn't do that. Once that had happened, they had to rename it something. And Steel was, I guess, as good as anything. Very, very sad thing.
Yep. And we'll get off this topic because I think, it's kind of a morbid thing to talk about, but it is something that was major with this film. And we'll just segue into, we talked about Lee Majors starred in this, and pretty much everybody knows Lee Majors from several different TV shows, either The Big Valley, The Fall Guy, which obviously you know how his relationship must have been with stuntmen for him to star in a TV show about stuntmen and also being a bounty hunter and doing the stunts. And of course, you and I, I'm sure, The $6 Million Man.
Yes, indeedy. That will always be my favorite Lee Majors project.
We had to have his leap in there, the bionic leap.
Yes, indeedy.
And Mary, that was for you. If you're listening to this episode, I put a bionic sound in there for you because I know Nick didn't do it because I listened to that episode. I put it in. But I didn't have to edit it in. I put it in as we were doing the recording. So there's tricks to saving yourself some editing, just have it ready to go. But how do you feel he did in this movie? I think he did a very good job.
I think he was excellent in this film. I think this film was a good fit for him. And it's like some of the roles that he had that were, you know, his bigger roles, the roles you think of him as. It's an action film. It's he plays a rugged sort of manly man in this film. And I just think that worked well for him. It worked well that he's playing a man who had gotten out of the business because of an accident on the job, somewhat caused. So I think he's able to convey that. But overall, I thought he was great. I think this was a really good fit for him.
And for listeners to know, the reason I spent on the plot synopsis talking about the guy at the beginning that froze, that is something that happened to Mike Cotton, the character Lee Majors is playing. He was on his last job. He froze and he had to be pulled off the beam. And that's when he basically walked away from the job. So during this movie is him overcoming that freezing, so to speak, and where he's able to do that, which happens in one of the night scenes when a storm's coming in. And the one guy playing the kid, Ben Marley, you know, gets knocked unconscious, is teetering going off the building, and the wind blows the things that are covering the beams. So you have to actually walk the beams instead of just walking along the metal planks, so to speak, or the metal flooring. And he, because of the guy, you know, the kids, and that's the name they always call him, the kid, his life being in danger, he is able to overcome that at that point.
Right. Yeah. He hadn't been up high on a building since he had frozen, and he had to overcome that pretty quickly because he had to get up there to supervise the work and in some cases to do it. So, yeah, I think he did a really nice job with that. I thought he was really good in this film.
Now, he got to pick his own crew. And when I was watching the names pop up, because I went in this movie blind, only knowing about the movie where you said in the B-movie cast, and I'm seeing the different names pop up that are in there, and I see Richard Lynch. And every time I see Richard Lynch's name, I always think, okay, he's the bad guy. And then I find that he's not playing Eddie. So I'm thinking, oh, maybe he's another bad guy. No, he's playing Dancer, who's one of these guys that Lee Major's character, Mike, recruits to get onto the team to help get this job done, this hand-picked crew. And he's a good guy. He's kind of like an anti-hero type because he's an antagonist, but he's also on the side of the good guys at the same time. But so he does have that Richard Lynch stuff I'm looking for, where he's a little bit despicable, but he's actually, at this time, on your side.
Yes. Yes. He was part of a group of guys that Lee Majors recruits who are kind of all in a way that way. I mean, when he talks about the list that he's going to go try and recruit, it's all, oh man, I don't know if we want to work with that guy. He's really troublesome or difficult or has these problems, but they're all guys he knows can get the job done if he can motivate them correctly. And that's true of Richard Lynch's character too. And they all end up being guys that in different ways become important to getting that done. So at various points, they all are key to moving the project forward and getting it completed. And it's an amazing group of actors. I mean, this film, for what it was, had a really robust cast. I mean, George Kennedy, Art Carney, Robert Tessier, Roger Mosley, Terry Kaiser, all these guys are actors that went on to or had done big, important stuff and are immediately recognizable to anyone who's at all a movie or TV fan. I mean, they're people you know and remember and can think of roles they played.
And Jennifer O'Neill, not the one to leave her
Jennifer
out.
O'Neill, sure, yeah. I mean, it's a really great cast, and they're all good. There isn't any of them that isn't good.
Oh, Robert Tessier, who played Cherokee. Again, another guy who I always associate playing the tough, the heavy, you know, and
right.
And my go-to with tying Richard Lynch and Robert Tessier together is the Sword and the Sorcerer, where they both are playing bad guys in it. And I rewatched it recently with my son, literally like a week or two ago. And so here I am watching them on the other side. And it was just kind of like funny because, you know, Cherokee, there's nothing really where you think he's evil or hard to work with. He's just focused, this tough heart, you know, this tough guy
right.
that wants to get it done and has some cool lines to say, you know, that kind of thing. And him and Dancer don't like each other, but of course, as, you know, the movie goes on, they bond.
Right.
But Dancer, out of all of them, I think he's the one who, besides the villain being an antagonist, he's the antagonist on the crew because he realizes that Mike Cadden is scared to be on the top and doesn't want to go up to
right.
the high heights and start. He realizes early on and then brings it out to everybody's attention and leaves the job. And then eventually does come back, you know, cause he leaves the job. Cause I'm not going to go up on top if you're not going to go up on top.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he clearly sees an issue here, something he can challenge. And he does. And, you know, that becomes an issue for Lee Major's character in the film. He has to overcome in order for things to come out right at the end.
Oh, exactly. And I was surprised with Terry Kaiser because I always think of him in other films, and here he is playing Valentino, and you know, and he's the romantic. He seems to have a different woman every day on the show. You know, like something
right.
different's
yeah.
dropping him off.
Yeah, I agree. It's not the kind of role I typically think of him in. But then mostly when I think of Terry Kaiser, I think of him playing Bernie in Weekend at Bernie's. So he's basically playing a dead body for most of that film. But yeah, it's kind of wild to see him do that. That was an interesting casting choice for sure.
Oh, I agree. And then, of course, you know, pre-Magnum P.I., I think, because the Magnum P.I. came out in the early 80s, and this was 79, so this was just before Magnum. Right. You know, with Roger Moseley in there playing, I'm just like, oh, man, you know. And he and I can't remember the other guy, the other actor's name, but the blonde-haired gentleman, they're providing the comic relief, and that usually tells you right away, if you're the comic relief in an action movie, one of you, or maybe both of you, are not long for the movie.
Yeah, there were a number of times when, yeah, you kind of thought that might be. But, yeah, they're kind of the chorus almost. And you can kind of see TC in Roger Moseley's performance, but it is very different than TC.
I do like his line. I wish I remember the actor that had the blonde hair. When Lee Majors' character Mike is about to fight the guy who is there, I think it's R.G. Armstrong who plays Kellen. And he flipped his truck over to get the steel off of it because he wouldn't move his truck because he was on lunch break. And they make a side bet. And of course, Lionel, Roger Mosley's character, says, oh, he's going to do it in three or less punches, you know, three or less moves or whatever. He's right. Going to take him down. And he takes him down in two. And I love it when he goes, one blow, one knee, less than three, pay me.
Yep. Yeah, he has a lot of good lines. Lionel does. Lionel's a great character.
And when his friend does fall and die, and he has the death scene with him and stuff like that, he has that emotional scene and that kind of stuff. And it's just his character is one that had some arc or some things happening to it. Not all the characters had things that happened to them in the supporting part, but Lionel's character did.
Yeah, I liked Lionel a lot. He was a fun character. He is a fun character.
What were some of your favorite parts of the movie? Do you have a favorite thing or two?
Well, I don't want to give away the ending, but the ending I think is really cool. I when I first saw it, never thought about it being accomplished that way. But it's a really neat ending. I thought it kind of needed Ride of the Valkyries personally, but I thought it was a really, really cool ending. And I had to wonder what that was like for the people of Lexington to watch that happen, because it had to have happened over a fair, decent part of the city. I mean, to be able to do what they did. So I thought, I think that's one of my favorite parts of the film. I like a lot of the sweeping shots around town, because again, I can see how much town has changed in that time period since, you know, the 45 years or whatever since this thing was shot. The shots up on the high steel were very nerve-wracking for me. So to me, that was a part of the film that I thought was really well done, and that made the film enjoyable to me, to have that, you know, feeling on the edge like that. The scene that they shot in Rupp Arena, as a loyal, longtime hardcore Wildcats fan who has spent countless hours in that building, it's been a long time since it's looked like it does in the film. And that was a neat throwback to me. The shot in the cemetery was a neat shot. It's a moving part of the film when they do the funeral. That's Lexington Cemetery, which is a beautiful, beautiful cemetery. Henry Clay is buried in that cemetery, so I spend lots of time over there. And now I will probably see if I can figure out, I might have to see if I can find a still of that shot to figure out where in the cemetery they shot it. But that's a beautiful shot. I mean, it's a beautiful place. So that, you know, that was neat. The scene, I forget which is it. It's not Terry Kaiser's character. It's a guy that wears the red, white, and blue hard hat that rappels down from under the bridge.
Oh, that's Dancer.
Yeah, Dancer.
Richard Lynch.
Richard Lynch, when he goes and rounds up Dancer, that bridge is a bridge over the Kentucky River. All of it is shot in Lexington. There's parts where they try to imply like he hands Dancer an airline ticket. Well, he's all 25 miles from Kincaid Tower when they shot that. So they're making like, oh, he's way off somewhere. He's not. He's just down the road. And I've been over that bridge a gazillion times. And it's hard to see where they are under it because it's right under the bridge. But that's a neat bridge. And I think that shot demonstrates more than it, you know, it makes it feel a lot higher than it does when you drive across it. You can't see completely straight down like that. So it's amazing how high that bridge really is over the river at that spot. But that's a neat shot, watching them rappel down the bridge support, the bridge column.
One of my favorite scenes was the opening where the phone call comes in to this limousine and you get the chauffeur is in the back seat. And George Kennedy's Big Lou is driving, and he's talking to the
Big hauling butt,
driving reckless and everything. And he's explaining to you. You only hear his end of the conversation, the chauffeur. Right. You don't hear the other person's side. And it's almost like, well, why are you talking on the phone? He's good. Or why are you not driving? And Big Lou doesn't like me driving because I get too many tickets. As he's swerving against traffic and going back, and the guy's just like bobbing and weaving, drinking a beer. And it gets handed to Big Lou. And George Kennedy, my God, it reminds me of Airport when he gets that phone. And it was just like, he was like channeling that character for his like 10, 15 minutes in the film.
Yeah.
Boom. He's just going to play that character. And I did not know Big Lou was going to do the big fall, you know, and stuff like that. So I had no idea. And I was expecting, this is the way they're going to introduce it. They already built up why he might need somebody to help him finish the building. You know, because of all this backstabbing and business dealings and all this other stuff. But to have him die like that, I realized it when it was coming. When, you know, the way the guy was clinging to him that froze up, I was like, oh, he's going to fall. Big Lou's going to fall, you know, because he's being held on to by this guy. And so I wasn't, at that point I knew. But prior to that, I had no idea. But he was just, I was just really enjoying how George Kennedy brought this energy and, like a man 20 years, 30 years younger than he probably was, you know, just going up there, climbing. Of course, you know, it's a double climbing up the steel thing because it's a distance shot, but he was doing all the work, looking and really giving his 15, you know, 10, 15 minutes was probably just there for a couple of days, maybe, you know, three at the tops of filming, but he really, whatever they paid him, it was definitely worth the money.
Yes, absolutely. He was great. He's great in most things, but yeah, he was great. When he did the phone call, I don't know if you picked up on the date. He says the date, and then they talk about, you know, having to have it topped out. The date was August 2nd, and the top-out date was a few days later. So I watched that film, when you sent me the link, on or about August 2nd. And I thought, well, that's really weird. So here we are watching it across the actual days they talk about in the film. And they shot it, I think, close to that. I mean, the fall on which Bakunas was killed was like September 21st, 1978. So they had to have finished it sometime fairly close to August of 78. So we're right at 45 years from the completion of this film. But watching them drive through, and the way they shot that, they show the scenes with Kincaid Tower. They're cutting back to that where they're going. But all the scenes on the highway, I'm not sure where they were around town or outside town, but it looks all green and wooded. So they can't be right downtown because there's nothing like that right close to downtown. So they had to be a little further out. And they just intersplice it so it looks like they're driving through this green city or whatever. It's kind of weird. But those are things that unless you live here, you're not really going to necessarily pick up on. So, and one of the things that for me makes it challenging to watch is that my mind is divided between wanting to follow the plot and what the characters are doing, and on the other side, trying to watch all the cool scenery and all the places they're going and saying, well, they're here and there and whatever. So, you know, that was kind of a interesting challenge that I don't normally have when I watch a film. I don't normally think about those things much.
And that's why I think this is like you and I were talking about when I sent you the link to the YouTube thing. And I said to you, well, you know, it's on YouTube now. It doesn't mean it's on YouTube tomorrow. But if you own a physical copy, you got it forever.
Yeah, I think I'll have to look for one. This is a film I'd like to have for that reason. But it'd be nice to find one. I don't know if any of them have commentaries or anything. That would be really cool, and they may not. But if I could find one that did, that would be awesome.
Now, somebody put this on IMDb, right, which we all know is always 100% accurate.
Yes, indeed.
So, according to this IMDb post, a wooden mock-up set was constructed on the roof of the nearby Patterson Office Tower of the on the University of Kentucky campus. Most of the top floor scenes were filmed there, as not to interfere with the actual construction of the Kincaid Building, which is the stand-in for the Hayes Tower depicted in the film, which you mentioned earlier.
Right.
So I'm not sure, like, maybe some of these scenes, like we're seeing, like we're, if you're seeing things, it could be because they were at that location, and that might be why you saw it. You know the area more than I do. Maybe that's why there was more green.
Well, that location is about, from Kincaid Tower to the Patterson Office Tower is probably no more than a mile, maybe a little more. That's right in the center of UK campus, and it's where a lot of the UK professors have their offices. It's a big, tall, 15 or 16-story tall office tower, and they did exactly that. Because the building was actively under construction, they didn't want to stop construction or be delayed or interfered with and trying to get the building done. So anytime they couldn't shoot on the actual site, they went down to the UK and they built a set and shot at the top of the Patterson office tower so that they could keep both projects moving along properly. So that's not very far away. And that is more green. I mean, the campus has some green to it, would have had more then than it does now. They built it up heavily. I mean, every time you turn around, UK's throwing something up. Sometimes they're tearing down, but they've built an awful lot of buildings in there. But yes, that's exactly accurate. They built a second piece, second set, second location over there where they shot when they couldn't shoot down at Kincaid.
Well, Eric, of course we knew it was accurate. It's on IMDb. And like I said,
right.
It's always
right. That is accurate. That's, yes.
Listeners, of course, if you can't see it, but we're both rolling our eyes about the IMDb stuff. So it's it's like anybody really knows a movie. If you go on IMDb, eventually you'll find inaccuracies in there, and then you have to wonder like when is it accurate and not accurate. And the only way to find out for sure is like in Eric's case, somebody that knows the area themselves and was there when it was being filmed, or talking to people that were on the crew of the film. You know, and that kind of stuff. And then when you can find out what is true and not true.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember when this was filmed, I was 7 and a half and we had lived in Lexington for about 2 years when it was filmed. So I hadn't been here long, but I've been here enough to know it a little bit. And of course it was quite the talk of the town at the time that it was shot. I mean, that was a big deal. We've had some films since then, but that was the first of that sort. And it's really the only where the whole film, wall to wall, was filmed on location in Kentucky, or in Lexington. Most of the rest, they filmed some parts, like Seabiscuit and Secretariat were both filmed in part in Lexington, but not totally. So those are films that, you know, people here locally were involved with and that sort of thing. But that was the first one totally filmed here. So that was quite a thing for Lexington at the time.
There are some things in this film that I thought were interesting, and some things I thought were kind of predictable. You know, like sometimes you're watching certain films, especially when you and I have both seen tons and tons of films. So you start to pick on certain tropes and certain things that are going to happen. And some things I was spot on. One thing I was dead wrong with, I thought when Dancer and the kid were introduced, I thought the kid was a red shirt from Star Trek right off the bat. I was just waiting for that to be the big thing that caused the rift between Dancer and Mike. Was something's going to happen to the kid. Either he's going to get hurt or he's going to be killed. And that kind of stuff. And of course they have that scene with him where I already spoiled that, like Mike's character does save him to get over his fear of heights and that kind of thing. But that was the thing I thought that was going to cause the rift. But like we said earlier, it was him figuring out that Mike did not want to get on the top and he didn't want to work for him. That was the thing. But did you think the same thing when the kid was introduced, that he was going to be a goner later on, or was it just me?
Yeah, I mean, they set him up in a way that he's this really fresh-faced young kid. you know, he talked about how he worked on the World Trade Center, and then eventually they asked, well, what did you do? I laid carpet. Okay. All right. So, yeah, I mean, it just sets up, I mean, it would have been a typical Hollywood thing to have the kid get hurt and have that be the wedge, like you say. He ends up doing really pretty well and, you know, kind of becomes a hero. I mean, he's part of the storm scene and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was interesting that they did that. It was a nice diversion from the expectation. I agree.
And for listeners to know, when we say the kid, I think this guy was like 20 years old. He was an apprentice, you know, for under Dancer. So he's probably late teens, early 20s. You know, that's the age he looks. So he's just a kid compared to the rest of them. But he's not like a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old.
Right, yeah. Yeah, just starting his career where the rest of these guys have been doing it for years and are seasoned vets. He's obviously on his first job where he's actually out on the steel.
And what I thought was interesting during the film, when Lionel was talking to his buddy, when they got the crew together and the crew's showing up at the scene and they're like, that's Dancer, that's Cherokee, that's Tank, and they're naming off all the guys, that's Surfer. And I never thought of construction guys as having they're all-stars. You know, it's like the all-star team is here. This is the crew of crews. And you realize that every specialty group, like whatever job you do, there are people that eventually you find out through, if you take enough effort, these are the best of the best, or these are the guys that are up the top of the level. And you realize that you're dealing people that could be personalities could be jerks. Like Ty Cobb was a total a-hole, but one of the greatest baseball players ever, but he was an a-hole, and that kind of thing. But they're also people recognize the talent that they bring to their profession. And I thought that was interesting. I never would have thought that construction guys would have they're you know, like we know that much in the knowledge of it and know this is the crew. Not everybody knew that, but those two guys did. Like, this is the crew to work with.
Right. I mean, I guess that kind of makes sense. I've never worked construction. I don't know a lot about how construction works, so I don't know if it's really that way. But, you know, in most professions, there are people who rise to the top are the people that everyone knows, well, that guy has done this, that, and the other thing, and is, you know, the top guy in the field or whatever. So I guess it would make sense that in construction, you'd have those guys who are the guys that have worked on all the really big projects that, you know, when the chips are down, some really difficult part of the project comes, they're the ones that you expect to get it done. So that makes sense. And I could see, you know, reputations preceding them and that people would be in awe of them or say, oh man, that guy's a hard ass. I'm going to have to work with him now. You know, he's one of those people that's just tough to work with or whatever. But yeah, it was interesting to have that kind of all-star lineup that he has to put together to get this job done.
Yeah, it just totally took me by surprise. I was just like, what? Okay. And I think I just rolled with it, you know, because I'm sure in your field, right, there are certain guys that work in museums and other stuff like that that you'd love to be on the job with or do something with or setting up an exhibit or just do anything. You'd be like, I get to work with them. Even if it's a smaller part, you're just like, you know, it's just to be near them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would say that's definitely true.
But otherwise, I mean, I'm really glad that you mentioned this movie and I got to watch it. And I don't think we should spoil the ending. I think we should leave the ending for people to seek out. But it is a great ending. It is an ending I totally did not expect. I knew something was going to be done, and I knew they had a plan because they never. But I love it because they never say the plan up front. It's like you could tell there's a plan in motion,
right?
And you, as the audience, find out just like everybody else that didn't know the plan. And I sometimes appreciate that with movies where you don't have the plan spoiled for you up front. You get to find out when it's happening.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I thought that was well set up. Yeah, you're right. I mean, clearly, Mike has it all figured out, and Lou's daughter, I mean, they clearly have come up with a, yeah, get, they've come up with a plan. They've come up with a way to get around the problems and get it solved. But it's not one that you would ever expect. It's not, I never saw that coming. And like I say, I wish I could remember, I should look in the paper or something. It had to be a spectacle when that was filmed here in town. I mean, I just can't imagine watching that go on. And it, there would have been, you would have been able to see it from all over. I mean, it wouldn't be something they could hide. So, yeah, that had to be really interesting.
And that's the beauty of a movie filmed back in 1978 coming out in 1979, is that you didn't have to worry about all the stuff nowadays where people are going to leak it out, where you'd have drones and all these other stuff doing the footage, and everybody would know, because it would have been, there's no way you could have kept it secret because of the way it was done. Of course, nowadays it would have been all done, you know, on green screen and stuff like that, or blue screen or whatever.
It would have just been done digitally or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, that's all true. And I don't know that you could do that in most places, but Lexington was a small enough town at that time. I mean, there are shots you can see where the police have the streets blocked off in the film. I mean, you can see that going on. And they could do that in Lexington without major uproar. In fact, Lexingtonians probably thought, wow, man, that's really cool. We're making this movie, whatever. You know, you shut the town down, do what you got to do. That wouldn't be the case in a lot of places. And I'm not sure it would be the case now. I think it would be very hard to do that in downtown now, as congested and as crowded is that as it is, and with all the firms and businesses and all that downtown. I don't know, you know, that they would have, they probably would not have been, would not be real enthused about being that disrupted, because it would shut down downtown. I mean, it would make it very difficult for an awful lot of people to get to work, school, whatever. I mean, it would have just been really hard to do. So yeah, it's interesting to see a film where you could really see the utility and import of practical effects and doing things that way, which, you know, you don't see that anymore that way very often.
And the only thing I want to make mention with the movie for me is I'm glad they didn't spend too much time on the love story. You know, it was just enough to be there in the background.
Right.
But, you know, because it's a 100-minute movie. So it's not like it's a movie that knows how to, you know, its pacing's well. It goes through it. Nowadays, movies seem like this type of movie would be 2 hours and 20 minutes, and we'd be saying, oh, it's a half hour too long, if they were to trim it. It's paced appropriately, and I think nowadays somebody would expand the love story or something else that would go on. And it's just enough there. And everybody has their, as we said at the end and during the film, everybody has a role that they play and bring something to it. It's not like one person comes there and takes charge. Lee Major's character comes to close because Mike is the one that gets the crew together and leads them. But it's more of a leadership where, okay, guys, I need you to do this. You're special. You're good at this. You're good at that. And he takes in stuff. And there's certain things where they all work together to get procure materials when necessary.
Right. Yeah. It's a neat film in that, like you say, everybody gets a chance. I mean, with the cast at large, you'd think there'd be people that kind of get lost in the film. And that's really not true. Everybody at some point gets featured and has a part to play in getting it done. And that's a nice and really neat thing to see it. It's I think, pretty taut there. Like you say, there's not a lot of it that you look at and you think, well, that could have been cut out, or that was unnecessary, or whatever. It all seems to have a purpose, and it moves along at a pretty good clip. There's not much that really drags, or you think, well, that was kind of an extraneous side thing that they didn't need to do, that didn't really advance the plot. So, yeah, I think it's well worth a watch.
Oh, I agree with you. And again, listeners, it's readily available on YouTube. Watch the movie. If you want to get the movie, do, like I said, a simple web search. It's out there at plenty of places. On one of them, mention Fifth Dimension Films. You can get it from one, you know, and that kind of stuff. Or you can get it from another place, but it's out there. You know, I don't know how good of a copies they are. I hope they're just as good, or if not better, than the YouTube version you and I saw, which was one of the better versions.
Yeah, it would be nice. Check it and see if it says whether it's the more recent sort of restored version. Be somewhat careful because it's liable to be, there are liable to be some of the old pan and scan copies out there. This is a film that really deserves to be seen in the restored version. I don't know if it's on the queue for somewhere like Shout Factory or somebody to release a full 4K with commentary or whatever. If they did, boy, that would be an awesome thing to see. But yeah, there's probably versions out there. So if you can find a nice one like the one on YouTube, well worth a look, well worth a have.
Especially because if they did that with commentary, Lee Majors, Jennifer O'Neill are both still alive, so you can get them. And, you know, there's portions of the cast that are also still with us, so now's the time to do it. You keep waiting there, you know, it's that time keeps going by, and next thing you know, it's you've passed that window period.
Right.
But before we say our proper goodbyes, Eric, I want to thank you for joining me on the show. And again, doubly thankful that you brought it up during the episode of The Norseman. I'm not holding it against you that you didn't like The Norseman because everybody has their own preferences. I'm not going to hold that for or against you. But you never saw it before and it was your first time seeing it. One day I'll have to do The Norseman on this show. But I know I won't bring you or Nick or Mary.
Well, Nick liked it. Nick would probably do it. I don't know. But I appreciate this opportunity. I mean, I'm really glad to get to talk about a film that I've known about a long time, and only relatively recently have I gotten to see it and enjoy it and, you know, be able to appreciate it both from a film perspective but from a local history perspective. And I'm glad to share it. I hope more people will see it, be able to see my hometown be featured in this way, and glad to be able to be here. So thanks a lot for having me. This is great.
Well, thank you. And if listeners, you want to hear more of Eric, he's on some episodes of the B Movie Cast. Episode 515 is his most recent one. It's also their most recent episode as we're recording this, The Norseman. But as you said, you go back, you know, if you do a little search, B Movie Cast, you put Eric Brooks in, I'm sure the other episodes will pop up that he's in, and you can go and listen to those and listen to other episodes without Eric, because the B-Movie Cast is a fun podcast. Nick's been on here before, so they know their stuff. They have fun. It's a nice show.
It is. It's an amazing cast. There aren't a lot that have made it to 515 episodes. I mean, that's pretty amazing unto itself. It's been pretty steady now for probably 15 years, and that's pretty amazing to have that longevity. That's a tribute to Vince Rotolo, who started it. He built something that even survived his unfortunate and untimely passing. So remarkable, and I'm very honored to be a small part of that. So yeah, if you haven't checked it out, definitely do so.
And listeners, I am on one episode of the B-Movie Cast, the dreaded Xanadu movie, which, you know, I love. Mary did not love.
Yes.
I'm on the Xanadu episode. So if you want to hear more of me, there's one episode too, besides the ones that Eric are on, that you can go for. But again, send us feedback to diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. And otherwise, I hope everybody has a good day. And watch Steel. It's right there on YouTube. Don't wait for it to be gone. Watch it now.
Hello, I hope everybody enjoyed that discussion about the movie Steel. And again, if you type in Steel 1979 on YouTube, you'll be able to find it and be able to give it a watch. It's very much worthwhile. I just want to let everybody know that Hammerama took a brief hiatus at the end of the summer due to circumstances beyond our control, but it'll be picking up again soon. So for those people that are missing our subsidiary series, Hammerama, just to let you know, it is coming. We just had some hiccups. For those that are unfamiliar with Hammerama, that's where we discuss movies that are made by Hammer Films. And I'm giving an idea a little more about that. We're going to listen to the promo for it to end the episode. And I hope everybody has a good day. And again, thank you for listening. Bye.
I'm Al from New Zealand.
And I'm Stephen from Maryland, USA.
We are Hammerama. Welcome to our new podcast, Enter Freely. And of your own will.
Part of the multi-award-nominated diecast movie podcast, Hammerama is a wide look at the world of Hammer horror from either side of the globe.
Each month, we will throw a die to decide which category from the film Vault of Hammer we are going to discuss. The Dracula, Frankenstein, or Mummy Cycles, science fiction, prehistory, or the experimental 1970s.
We will cast our international eyes across then and now reviews of the movie,
its place in the Hammerverse,
our encounters with the stars,
a film poster critique,
and unusual associated merchandise.
So join us for our bite-sized discussion of Hammer's gory glories, stitched together from both ends of the earth.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.